inshallah. Thank you so very much and goodbye.
Iran Zeder says enemies of the Islamic Republic do not want the country to boost ties with the world, including its neighbors Russia and China. The British Premier is facing more questions over a lavish makeover of his apartment as polls show the scandal is taking its toll on the Tories ahead of elections. And India registers a single-day record of nearly 3,700 deaths from the coronavirus and over 392,000 new cases. Our top story for this half hour, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says enemies do not want the country to boost its ties with the world. In a televised speech, Ayatollah Khamenei said the enemies complain when Iran wants to expand ties with Russia, China, and even its neighbors. The leader also hailed the valuable role played by the overseas branch of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He said the Quds Force is a main pillar of Iran's diplomacy in West Asia. Ayatollah Khamenei also said the best and most successful way to nullify sanctions is a genuine effort to boost national production. The leader also pointed to the upcoming presidential election, saying the polls are an important opportunity for Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that elections have always been clean in Iran. Elsewhere, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing more allegations over a lavish makeover of his Downing Street apartment. The Sunday Times says the total cost of renovating Johnson's residence was around $276,000. It says one invoice was directly settled by a Conservative Party donor that would need to be declared to tax authorities, according to British paper. A Conservative Party donor was also asked to pay for childcare costs of Johnson's young son. The British government has rejected the allegations. It says the Premier has paid the costs himself. The allegations seem to have taken its toll on the ruling Conservative Party. An opinion poll shows the party is losing its popularity ahead of upcoming elections. Said Puruzanmandan says if the UK Premier is found to have violated the ministerial code of conduct, his government may see top-level resignations.
The most recent polls have shown that the Conservative Party used to have a comfortable lead of 11%. Now it's gone down from that to only 5% against the opposition Labour Party. And that, I understand, is what the Labour Party is counting on in the elections that will be taking place next week, mayoral elections locally as well as other elections across the country, including in the devolved nations of Scotland, where we will be looking at parliamentary elections slated for Thursday. An investigation has been launched into these allegations, in particular the lavish refurbishment of the number 10 apartment. And if the Prime Minister is found to have violated the so-called ministerial code of conduct, then we're looking at a change at the top, a resignation at the very top of the British government.
Britain has defended severe cuts to its overseas aid spending, citing the economic impact of COVID-19. Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab said it has an extremely difficult decision to slash the aid budget. He added that the government is adopting a more strategic approach to get maximum value out of its foreign spending. The planned aid cut is worth $5.5 billion. It has drawn criticism, with at least three UN agencies warning of a devastating impact. The UN Children's Fund said the 60% cut to its UK funding will have serious consequences, the UN Population Fund also said. The plan would lead to some 250,000 more deaths around the world. German police say they've arrested over 250 people after May Day protests turned violent in Berlin Saturday. Police in the German capital called the violence unacceptable. They said around 50 officers were injured. Thousands attended several marches in Berlin as part of the traditional Labor Day workers' rights demonstrations. Violence broke out after police pulled a group of protesters out of the crowd for failing to adhere to pandemic hygiene regulations. The protesters pelted officers with stones and bottles and set fire to bins. Police used pepper spray to disperse the crowd. India has recorded its deadliest day of the coronavirus pandemic with nearly 3,700 fatalities in the last 24 hours. Sunday marks the fourth straight day that India registered more than 3,000 daily deaths. The Asian nation also reported over 392,000 new infections in the last 24 hours. Daily cases there have remained above 300,000 since April 22nd. India's total COVID deaths are over 215,000 out of 19.5 million cases. The virus surge is blamed on the government as it allowed millions of largely unmasked people to attend religious festivals and crowded political rallies in five states through March and April. Hospitals in India are currently overwhelmed. A shortage of medical oxygen is a most serious challenge. Our correspondent in New Delhi, Munawar Zaman, says a shortage of coronavirus vaccines has turned into a new challenge for India's crisis-hit healthcare system.
Well, besides having the oxygen supplies, which is still a great concern, which is the biggest concern the healthcare system is struggling with, there is now a biggest struggle with vaccine shortage. Vaccine is something which is not easily available to states. States are struggling with the vaccination supplies. And if you know the India's biggest vaccine supplier, the Serum Institute, its owner, Adar Punawala, has to leave the country. He has to leave India because he was getting threat calls from the elite class people or maybe some other groups. He had to leave the country to start production outside India.
In Myanmar, security forces have reportedly opened fire on anti-coup protesters, killing seven. According to local media, the Sunday killings happened in four different locations, including the city of Mandalay. People were out on the streets across Myanmar calling for a spring revolution against the ruling junta. They pledged to bring down what they called the military dictatorship. Myanmar has witnessed nationwide protests since the military ousted former elected government on February the 1st. The rallies have faced a crackdown that a local monitoring group says has killed some 760 people. The UN Security Council has called for the restoration of democracy and the release of all political prisoners in Myanmar. North Korea has warned the U.S. that it will face a very grave situation for sticking to over half a century of hostile policy toward Pyongyang. In a statement, North Korea's foreign ministry said U.S. President Joe Biden made a, quote, big blunder after he called for diplomacy and stern deterrence against Pyongyang. The ministry called the talk of deterrence a veiled nuclear threat and diplomacy a signboard for hostile acts. The ministry said this forces Pyongyang to take corresponding measures. In his Wednesday address to Congress, Biden said North Korea's nukes pose a serious security threat. His press secretary, Jen Psaki, later called for the complete denuclearization of North Korea. Pyongyang says its nuclear program is for self-defense amid the U.S. military's provocations on the Korean Peninsula. Kim Dao-ju, a senior fellow at the Pangol Institution, earlier joined us with his take on the latest row between the U.S. and North Korea.
It's really mostly up to the United States, you know, what kind of policy they are going to have toward North Korea. And then we would have the new kind of dynamics between the two countries and in the region. For example, in the Trump administration pursued a grand bargain, you do see summit diplomacy between the two sides, to the a lot of people like that, but unfortunately, because of the hawkish politicians inside the United States, their strong opposition, their sabotaging activity, so the summit failed. And then before that, you have Trump, you have Obama. Obama pursued strategic patience, basically doing very little. And now Biden says, basically, you know, I'm going to pursue a policy in the middle ground between Obama and Trump. So we can see, you know, basically describe that as a normal diplomatic approach to talk to the North Korean side. But it's really about, usually the U.S. Would, put forward a lot of requirement, a lot of demands, you know, what the North Koreans should do, and then the U.S. will react to their actions over there.
Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says an agreement has been reached to remove most individuals and entities from the U.S. sanctions list, but major differences still remain, and progress is slow. From Vienna, Homolesky reports.
Another Joint Commission meeting among the remaining signatories of the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, comes to an end in Vienna. Iranian lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says an agreement has been reached to remove the majority of individuals and entities on the U.S. sanctions list, and that negotiations are continuing on the rest of the names on the list. Araghchi had mentioned earlier that the U.S. has also agreed to lift sanctions on Iran's energy, finance, insurance, automotive and shipping sectors. But Iran is demanding the removal of all U.S. sanctions imposed after the U.S. withdrawal from the deal in 2018, including those imposed under other labels by the Trump administration.
It's a very complicated issue, and as you know, sanctions have different categories, and we have to deal with all of them. Of course, what is our guiding principle is the positions, the firm positions taken by the Islamic Republic of Iran and has been emphasized by the Supreme Leader.
Iran has also steadfastly opposed a step-by-step process, saying it would only go back to full compliance after all U.S. sanctions are lifted and the Islamic Republic verifies their effective removal. Araghchi said delegates are now involved in the time-consuming process of drafting an agreement.
Now we have some texts available to us based on the negotiations we have already made, and now we are working on the words and phrases and sentences and paragraphs.
EU coordinator Enrique Mora said there were moderate advances, adding that with more detail comes more complexity. While the U.S. delegation led by Robert Malley has been engaged in negotiations in Vienna, there's been no direct talks between Iran and the U.S. Delegates have decided to have further consultations in their respective capitals before returning for another joint commission session here at the end of next week. Homolezgi, Vienna.
Elsewhere, dozens more Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds are set to lose their homes as part of Israel's land grab policy to expand its illegal settlements. The Palestinian families say they are being forced to move to make way for a brand new settlement in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. It comes after a court ruled that at least six families must vacate their homes in the area by Thursday, despite having lived there for generations. A separate ruling by the same court means seven other families face eviction by August the 1st. That's a total of 58 people, including 17 children. Under international law, the Israeli judicial system has no legal authority over the population it occupies. This week, Human Rights Watch said Israel's persecution of Palestinians and settlement policy amount to apartheid and the crime against humanity. Mona Candil earlier joined us from Ramallah. She gave details about Israel's settlement construction in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds.
Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem al-Quds is a little bit different because the Israeli regime claims that they discovered that the homes where dozens of Palestinians lived in Sheikh Jarrah belong to Jewish people, and that the Israelis want to vacate all those Palestinians living there in order to replace it, the neighborhood entirely with a Jewish settlement and to bring the Israeli settlers there. Now, the Jerusalem District Court ruled that at least six families must vacate their homes in Sheikh Jarrah today on Sunday. The same court ruled that seven other families should leave their homes by August the 1st. In total, 58 people, including 17 children, are said to be forcibly displaced to make way for Jewish settlers to live in the Sheikh Jarrah area. Clashes continue to take place between Palestinians and Israeli settlers who are backed by the Israeli police officers in Jerusalem. Al-Quds.
A fire has broken out at an abandoned parking lot near Israel's Ben-Gurion Airport on the outskirts of the city of Lod. According to Israeli media, the cause of the incident is not yet known. No casualties have been reported either. Six firefighting teams have already arrived at the scene. Additional forces are on their way too. Israeli police have started evacuating residents from nearby homes. All entrances to the area have been blocked to traffic. A new U.S. government report suggests the aid Washington offered to Venezuela in 2019 was directed at regime change in the Latin American nation. According to an audit by the U.S. Agency for International Development, materials sent to the Colombian border in February 2019 were planned to be distributed by allies of Venezuelan opposition figure Juan Guaido to reinforce his credibility.
An audit by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has revealed that Washington's effort in February 2019 to send aid to Venezuela was part of a plot to change the legitimate government of President Nicolas Maduro in the oil-rich Latin American country. The USAID report noted that the aid offer was not planned in alignment with humanitarian principles, but for supporting pro-Western figure Juan Guaido. That is while Venezuela was grappling with chronic shortages of food and medicine. The document said materials sent to the Colombian border region in February 2019 were planned to be distributed by the allies of Venezuelan opposition figure Juan Guaido to reinforce his credibility. The U.S. administration, under the former President Donald Trump, planned for the aid supplies to be carried out by Guaido's allies across the Colombian border into Venezuela. However, the Venezuelan government blocked the aid convoys at the time, calling the U.S. move a violation of the country's sovereignty. In reaction to the audit, the Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza said the U.S. offered aid to the oil-rich nation 2 years ago in a bid to overthrow the government in Caracas. Also, the Venezuelan Information Minister Freddy Nunez called the so-called U.S. humanitarian support an excuse in which Washington sought to break Venezuela's territorial sovereignty. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. The Trump administration recognized Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela and publicly pursued a regime change policy against Maduro. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has reaffirmed the U.S. recognition of Guaido as the interim president and has ruled out negotiations with Maduro anytime soon. Washington has been pursuing a regime change in Venezuela and has imposed crippling sanctions on the country to force Maduro out of power. The organization USAID has been accused of political interference in the past. It has used aid and the notion of democracy promotion to interfere in countries like Russia and Cuba. Venezuela has been no exception.
Well, I would say yes, the U.S. does lose credibility when its plans get exposed, but that won't deter the United States from trying to push forward these plans. Really, what we have in the U.S. is there's one end goal, one end interest, and that interest is the interest of imperialism, of trying to open up markets and take resources from other nations that the U.S. either does not have enough of or would want to have more of. You know, one of those resources in terms of Venezuela being oil.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-aliyyi al-azim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyyina Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Wa ala alihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin la siyama baqiyyatillahi fil aradin ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif wa ja'alana min a'wanihi wa ansarihi wa shi'atih. We've been studying different characteristics of the community of Ahlul Bayt, and we said based on the Quran and Hadith, a very important characteristic is to enjoin the good and prohibit the bad. Now I want to refer to the section on Amr al-Ma'ruf wa Nahi anil Munkar in the manual. All our Maraja have this in their Risale, and but this is according to Ayatollah Sistani Hafizahullah. So he starts with an introduction, and he says Amr al-Ma'ruf wa Nahy al-Munkar are two of the greatest obligations, two of the greatest religious obligations. Then he refers to the ayah that we discussed, wal takun minkum ummatun yad'una ila al-khair wa ya'muruna bil ma'ruf wa yanhauna 'anil munkar wa ulaika humul muflihun. Then he quotes a hadith from Rasulullah. You know, when a marja quotes a hadith, it's very important. It means that this hadith is 100% verified by marja. لا تزال أمتي بخير ما أمروا بالمعروف ونهوا عن المنكر وتعاونوا على البر. Rasulullah said, my community, my nation will be always in right condition as long as they do amr ma'ruf and they prohibit munkar and help each other to do good. Ta'awanu ala al-bir. They help each other, they assist each other for doing good. فَإِذَا لَمْ يَفْعَلُوا ذَلِكَ. If they don't do this, نُزْعَتْ عَنْهُمُ الْبَرَكَاتِ. Allah will take away His blessing. Then you would see there would be poverty. There would be so many disasters. There would be tyrant governments. وَسَلَّتَ بَعْضَهُمْ عَلَىٰ بَعْضٍ وَلَمْ يَكُنْ لَهُمْ نَاصِرٌ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا فِي السَّمَاءِ. Then Allah will make bad people rule them. Then they would have no helper in on this earth nor in the sky. Then he quotes the section from Amirul Mu'mineen's will that I mentioned, you know, in the end of his life. Then the first mas'ala is this. Amr ma'ruf and nahi an munkar are wajib when that ma'ruf is obligatory. You know, sometimes someone doesn't do something which is mustahab or does something which is makruh. Here it is good to recommend to do mustahab, but it is not wajib. But if that ma'ruf is obligatory, then amr ma'ruf becomes obligatory. So depending whether that ma'ruf or munkar are necessary or recommended to be done or not to be done, then amr ma'ruf becomes wajib or mustahab. Then Agha adds that this is wajib kifai. This is responsibility of entire community, but if some of them do this wajib, then the rest would be relaxed. But if no one does this, all of them are responsible. All of them have to answer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala why none of us did this. Then Agha says that when munkar is done or ma'ruf is not done, although some people should do amr ma'ruf, but everyone should show his or her dislike. You cannot say, okay, few people would, you know, show dislike, it's enough. When it comes to a matter of showing disapproval and dislike, everyone should do this. And then he quotes from Amirul Mu'mineen that Rasulullah said, when you meet people who commit sin, your face must show that you are not happy. That you are not happy with the sin that they commit.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Then he makes a very important point. He says when you are doing amr ma'ruf wa nahy anil munkar, you must also consider the personality of that person, the position and status of that person. You know, maybe that person is older than you. Maybe that person is a person who is, you know, very respected in community. So observe that and do it in the way that would not be insulting that person. Because, you know, we do this for the sake of good. We don't want, you know, to find, you know, problems in people and say, you know, I am better than you. Our purpose is to improve. So if someone is a person who is very, you know, old or very, you know, prestigious or very respected, you should know how to handle this issue without insulting him. Especially, you shouldn't do this in front of people, because we don't want to harm anyone. And then also Aga says that you must not do it in a very rigid and harsh way, so that that person would totally then start hating religious people and religion. You know, sometimes a person has a problem with one issue, but then you make it so big that he would start hating all ulama and all, you know, religious people. So you have to be careful about this. Then he mentions few conditions and few stages. So one is that you should yourself know ma'ruf and munkar. This is actually leading us to the next topic that inshallah I'm going to talk from tomorrow, that a community of Ahlul Bayt is a community which is knowledge based. This is very important. Inshallah we will talk about it. So you should know ma'ruf and munkar. At least you should have some knowledge. Maybe you don't need to be a scholar. You don't need, you know, to have done lots of research, but at least you should be aware of what you are saying to people. But then Aga says, this doesn't mean that you don't have responsibility to learn. So there are certain issues that you have to go and learn. So for example, if my child is not observing hijab properly, I cannot say, I don't know this, so I have no responsibility. So you have to go and check what are the requirements for hijab, and then you tell your child or people that are in your reach. So one important thing is to know ma'ruf and munkar. Another important requirement is to see that there is a possibility of having some impact, some influence, some effect. If you are 100% sure that it is useless, then you don't say it. It's not necessary. But Aga says it is ihtiyat wajib, that even if you are 100% sure, you still show that person that you are not happy. You express your disapproval. But here I have to add something. Sometimes because we are either pessimistic or lazy, we always say, no, there is no point. Useless. You know, to make life easy for ourselves, we say it's useless. But who said it's useless? When Allah says to Musa and Harun, speak to Fir'aun, لَعَلَّهُ يَتَذَكَّرُ أَوْ يَخْشَى, so I cannot say it's useless to talk to people. You should try it. So if you are really, really sure that it is useless, maybe then you don't need to do lots of things, but you should be optimistic. Inshallah, it will work, especially if I say, then tomorrow another person says, you know, then another person says. The third condition is that that person must be insisting on this. Sometimes a person, for example, doesn't remember. A lady is passing by, she is a mu'mina, but, you know, some pieces of hair is, you know, visible. It's not that she's insisting on this. So this is not wajib to go and say, you know, your hair is visible. Or sometime, you know, a person forgot to say his prayer. We were traveling, he forgot. It's not that he's insisting on not saying prayer. So if that person is not insisting, it's not wajib. Another thing is that that person must not have excuse. If he has an excuse which is legitimate, then it is not wajib. But if that ma'ruf or munkar are among those things which are fundamentally important in Islam, then even if he says, I have excuse, I have to do amr ma'ruf, like what Imam Hussein did. Or if, for example, as we say, it shouldn't have any considerable harm for you. But sometimes ma'ruf is so important
that even it leads to being hard, you have to be ready for that. So it depends on the amount of significance and importance of that ma'ruf. For certain ma'ruf, even giving life is not too much. But if it is a normal, for example, if I say to this person, you know, you should, you know, pay your homes, then he will, you know, for example, either kill me or my children. So this is not that wajib. So depending on what is the level of risk and the level of significance of that ma'ruf. So that person must not have excuse unless the issue is very important. And also it should not lead to any harm for you, for your money, for your life, for your reputation, or for the people that are also not necessarily you are harmed, but for example your children and other mu'minin are harmed, unless it is very, very important. Then Agha mentions there are different levels. One is to dislike in your heart and show disapproval. Second is to say by your tongue. And the third, if the first two levels don't work, because we go gradually, we don't start with the last level. If the first two doesn't work, then you may be required to do something physically. For example, to stop that person. Maybe there is a need to report that person. So there are many different things that you may be required. Inshallah, refer to Risala and find these. And in Mas'ala number 4, Agha says that the necessity of Amr bin Ma'ruf with respect to your family and those who are close to you becomes even more. You have greater responsibility for your family. Allah says in the Quran, قُوْ أَنفُسَكُمْ وَأَهْلِيكُمْ نَارًا. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala enable us and our community, inshallah, to observe this great obligation, and that is Amr Ma'ruf and Nahy an al-Munkar.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
O Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. O Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and all of Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. O Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana an alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Dilawar of Yakupi was born in Afghanistan's Khust province in 1979. Late in 2002, his family bought a used car for him to drive as a taxi. A few weeks later, on the eve of the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr, Dilawar's mother asked him to bring his three sisters from their nearby villages home for the holiday. However, he needed gas money and decided to drive to the provincial capital, Khust, to look for fares. On his way back, he found three men headed back towards Yakupi at a taxi stand there. On the way, they passed a base used by American troops, Camp Salerno, which had been the target of a rocket attack that morning. The Toyota was stopped, and a broken walkie-talkie was confiscated from one of Dilawar's passengers. Then the four men were detained and had to spend their first night handcuffed to a fence so they would be unable to sleep. They were later sent to Bagram Collection Point, the headquarters for U.S. forces in Afghanistan, and a key detention and interrogation center. According to Dilawar's fellow prisoners, for him, the most difficult thing seemed to be the black cloth hood that was pulled over his head. He could not breathe, they said. 5 days later, he was dead. The U.S. Army initially declared that Dilawar had died of natural causes, but a New York Times reporter named Carlotta Gall managed to track down Dilawar's family in Yakupi and found out from his death certificate that he had died of homicide. Further investigation revealed that Dilawar died of a pulmonary embolism caused by trauma to his legs that were so severe that the coroner said his legs were pulpified and looked like they had been run over by a truck. As Dilawar moaned and cried out for his mother and father, the guards would pummel him with knee strikes over and over again, just to shut him up, or sometimes for their amusement, just to hear him scream, "Allah."
But just that one night, he got kicked in the leg, maybe like 10 times.
Some of the soldiers said they started using the knee strikes essentially to shut him up because he was yelling and screaming.
The damage that was done from multiple strikes, and a lot of that could have been avoided had you known the person before you had fought with them and used that exact technique.
Sergeant Salcedo, who is an inexperienced interrogator but a kind of a can-do soldier, had this man who refused to look at her because she was a woman. She said she got very frustrated by this and grabbed him by the sides of the face and sort of turned him to face her and look at her and take her seriously. But of course, he was an Afghan man from a tribal conservative culture who didn't look at strange women.
Sergeant Salcedo was getting a little aggravated, so I kind of stepped in between them, and that's when I grabbed him by the shirt, and I brought him over to the wall.
Finally, Dilawar died on December 10th, only 5 days after he was transferred to the Bagram collection point.
The ceiling of these isolation rooms was just a simple metal grate, and it was thick enough you could put handcuffs, you know, through the wires of that, and it just kind of chain them up like that, out to the sides like this.
Did the treatment they received in those rooms cause the death of these two men?
First, we're not chaining people to the ceiling. I think you asked me that question before.
First, we're not chaining people to the ceiling. That's what he says.
The Bagram collection point is situated next to the Bagram airbase in the Parwan province of Afghanistan. The prison was built by the United States during the Bush administration. While initially intended as a temporary facility, it has been used longer and handled more detainees than the U.S. Guantanamo Bay detention camp in Cuba. It has also been compared to Abu Ghraib prison. Meanwhile, Captain Carolyn Wood, the officer in charge of interrogation at Bagram during Dilawar's incarceration, was later given a Bronze Star and sent to Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib prison was a prison complex in Abu Ghraib, Iraq, located 32 kilometers west of Baghdad. It was opened in the 1950s and served as a maximum security prison with torture, weekly executions, and squalid living conditions. From the 1980s, the prison was used by Saddam Hussein and later the United States to hold political prisoners. It developed a reputation for torture and extrajudicial killings and was closed in 2002. It was reopened by the US after the 2003 invasion. At 2 a.m. on November 4th, 2003, a man named Manadel Al-Jamadi was captured by Navy SEALs after a violent struggle at his house outside Baghdad. Jamadi savagely fought one of the SEALs before being subdued in his kitchen. Jamadi was considered by the CIA a suspect in an attack on the Al Rashid Hotel during a visit by Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz in October 2003. After he was removed from his house, he was transferred to CIA custody for interrogation at Abu Ghraib. He was taken to a shower room for interrogation. Then, some 45 minutes later, he was dead. After Jamadi's death, his corpse was packed in ice. The corpse was in the background for widely reprinted photographs of grinning U.S. Army specialists Sabrina Harmon and Charles Grainer, each of whom offered a thumbs-up gesture. Associated Press correspondent Seth Hatena reported that 30 minutes after beginning his questioning of the prisoner, the CIA interrogator called for guards to reposition Al-Jamadi, who he believed was playing possum as he slouched with his arms stretched behind him. But the guards found otherwise. After we found out he was dead, they were nervous, specialist Dennis Stavanis said of the CIA interrogator and translator. They didn't know what the hell to do. Staff Sergeant Ivan Frederick wrote an account to his family in November 2003 that interrogators had stressed him out so bad that the man died. Prison personnel put his body in a body bag and packed him in ice for approximately 24 hours in the shower. The next day, the medics came and put his body on a stretcher, placed a fake IV in his arm, and took him away. No one has been charged with his death. In 2011, Attorney General Eric Holder said that he had opened a full criminal investigation into Al-Jamadi's death. In August 2012, Holder announced that no criminal charges would be brought. It should be noted that these are only two examples of what the American forces have done in the detention camps in Iraq and Afghanistan. Based on compelling evidence, it can be said with certainty that what happened at Abu Ghraib and Bagram were no aberrations, but part of a widespread pattern.
In her sworn testimony about Abu Ghraib, Captain Woods said she felt pressure to produce intelligence. So she brought unauthorized techniques, dogs, nudity, sleep deprivation, and stress positions, to Abu Ghraib from Afghanistan. Wood maintained that the Bagram model had tacit approval from superiors, but U.S. Central Command had never responded to her requests for authorization. So the mystery remained. Was Abu Ghraib the work of a few bad apples, or evidence of a new worldwide system of detention and interrogation?
This debate is occurring because of the Supreme Court's ruling that said that we must conduct ourselves under the common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. And that common Article 3 says that, you know, there will be no outrages upon human dignity. It's very vague. What does that mean?
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BATR 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.